Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 16th of December. If you live in Detroit, today's news concerning the future of your newspapers is probably not very good. The Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News are planning to stop home delivery most days of the week. They will print a pared-down version of their papers for newsstands on those days, Sunday and either Thursday or Friday or both. And they are the first major dailies in the country to take such drastic steps. The announcement of their new business model will take place today. Of course, last week we had news that the Chicago Tribune Company had filed bankruptcy. They are $13 billion in debt. The Christian Science Monitor has become a strictly online news outlet, and the Kentucky Post as well. So what's going on with newspapers in the country? What's happening with advertising? Will there, I keep thinking, 5 years from now, will there be a morning paper? Many of you, I'm sure, as I do, go to the step of the house in the morning and get the newspaper. It's the first thing we do, or a couple newspapers. Will we be able to do that a year from now or a couple years from now? We're going to have two guests with us this hour, starting with Mark Jerkowitz, who's Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, has spent nearly 20 years covering the news media, was the press critic and author of the Boston Phoenix Don't Quote Me column, spent 10 years at the Boston Globe, initially as the paper's ombudsman, and then as its full-time media beat writer. He's taught at Northeastern University and at Tufts, has been a commentator on CNN and NPR, and in the 90s spent a number of years as a radio talk host in Boston. Later this hour, I don't know if you saw this story in the New York Times yesterday. It's titled An Imperiled Newspaper's Place in a Small City's Fabric. It's Dateline Bristol, Connecticut, and we'll be talking with the editor of what has been called in the article an ancient and endangered newspaper called the Bristol Press, a small-town newspaper that covers sports very well and that covers all that's going on in that town, which you'd think would be something that would need to be preserved, but it is imperiled. So, that's our conversation, the first hour of today's show. And we welcome your phone calls, as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you want to send an email, that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Mark. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Nice to be with you.
So terrible news out of Detroit. What would you do if you lived there and you counted on those newspapers on your doorstep? They're not going to be there most days of the week.
Well, you know, frankly, if more people counted on getting their news on their doorstep, maybe we wouldn't be in the industry wouldn't be in the shape that it's in. What you just talked about in Detroit at the Tribune Company, all over, frankly, the Rocky Mountain News in Denver, in Colorado, up for sale, perhaps not even going to get a buyer. News that the New York Times has borrowing against its new building in order to deal with its debt obligation. You know, it's like, frankly, for people in this business, it's like every day it's like reading the obituary pages for the industry. I'm looking at a very popular website today called Pointer.org, which aggregates news about journalism. And, here are the first two items on it. AP staffers stage byline strike to protest contract proposal. One in five newspapers considering outsourcing printing. It is, this is a bona fide crisis. And let me just say one thing. You know, up till now, kind of the conversation has been okay. And it's been an interesting one. You know, will there be a dead tree product, you know, at your doorstep 5 years from now, 3 years from now, 10 years from now? I think there's a more serious question as some of these companies begin to fail. It's not only is the dead tree product, you know, imperiled, but so is the whole journalism organization. And, you know, if a newspaper, this day and age, every newspaper has several components. One is, is the print product, and one is a website, and in many cases, a website that's probably getting more eyeballs than the newspaper. If these organizations can't survive, we're not only talking about the end of the print product, but we're talking about the end of the web product too. So the potential losses.
Oh my gosh!
Could be more. You know, obviously there'd be other websites, but you know, if news organizations are going to go under, they're going to go under in all their iterations in many respects. So, you know, it's scary times out there.
Whew, you've just taken my breath away. I don't know if I can carry on. This is terrible news.
Well, you know, here's I can remember going back as long as 15 or 20 years ago, when people said, you know, came to, you know, journalism panels and said, there's this thing, the internet, it's on its way, it's gonna be a meteor that strikes the media landscape, and it's gonna obliterate all known forms of journalism. And I can remember, you know, listening, watching as veteran print reporters put their heads in their hands 20 years ago and said, oh my God, our jobs are imperiled. What we actually found out was, and this has been the truth in the history of media in this country, one new media technology doesn't destroy all the other ones that pre-existed. You know, nobody thought radio could survive, for example, the advent of television. But it reinvented itself, and it did so. So it doesn't necessarily obliterate everything else that existed. We have seen in recent years, we know what the problem is with the print product. Two things. One, obviously, an aging demographic.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very difficult to get young people to buy newspapers. Decreasing circulation. And obviously, because, frankly, of sometimes the prime demographic isn't there, and because of the ability, you know, the opportunities caused by online advertising, a lot of advertising decreases, particularly in things like classified ads. And so there, for a while now, smart people have known that, hey, we are in a shift. We're in a technological shift. Yes, there will be print papers, but, you know, people are moving online. The eyeballs are moving online. Journalists are being deployed online. Look, Arthur Sulzberger Jr., the chairman of the Times Company, has said for years, I'm agnostic about how we deliver information. So there was an expectation, sure, people are going to get their news differently. It's going to happen over time. It'll be an evolutionary process. And there was this interesting debate. How long do you think it'll be before, you know, the print product is a niche product and the online product is really the daily news product? Will it be 10 years? Will it be 5 years? It was kind of an interesting debate. Then things started to worsen in the industry. And the bad news got worse. And the circulation and revenue news got worse. And then there was sort of another mindset that took hold, which was, okay, we're kind of, you know, in a rough patch here, but journalism organizations that run themselves wisely, there'll be about a 5 to 7 year rough patch, but when we emerge and reemerge, we'll be making money again, we'll probably be largely online, but journalism will be healthy. Well, I think now that you add on the overall economic crisis to all the other factors that have pre-existed, now I think that those arguments are giving way to a broader fear about exactly what kind of journalism is going to be left. How many reporters are going to lose their jobs? How many news organizations are going to go out of business? Who's going to be around to subsidize quality journalism? And in this kind of environment, things have gotten a lot scarier. There's a lot of talk about new business models, about nonprofits getting involved in news organizations. And one of the big issues here, and one of the dangerous things, is that the struggle to monetize online journalism, meaning figuring out how to make money from these news websites, has become a tougher issue.
Mm-hmm.
We know the problems with getting people to pay for content online. That's obviously been an issue. But even the advertising online, which was growing at a rapid rate in recent years, is starting to slow down. Slow down fairly dramatically. So if there was a sense at one point that there was going to kind of be a baton that was going to be passed, you know, that at the New York Times Company, that at some point, you know, the revenue gains on the internet side would make up for the revenue losses on the newspaper side and the organization would move on. Now that baton toss doesn't seem so likely. So now, you know, for people wondering about who's going to pay for quality journalism, I think it's a real issue.
Well, it begs the question then, where are we going to get our news? How could you cover, as the Tribune has the last couple of weeks, the Blagojevich scandal? How can you cover City Hall? Where are we going to get our news?
Very good question. I mean, you know, look, there are, you know, what we are, the big issue is we're living in a fragmenting media environment. And so, you know, every day, often online, people are devising new ways to cover news. There are hyper-local websites that are being run by citizen journalists in communities like San Diego. And I heard a man talk about this week. There's an investigative journalism website that's doing a lot of good coverage of City Hall and things like that. We know, for example, one of the most interesting experiments in journalism right now is an operation called ProPublica. It is basically an investigative bureau, really, an investigative news operation. It's got about 25 journalists. It's online. It was funded by a private wealthy donor from California, and they have sort of, you know, they are promising to do the kind of investigative work and disseminate it throughout the media that doesn't get done so much anymore in this day and age because it costs too much money. So there are, you know, the Kaiser Family Foundation is talking about starting its own health news service. So, you know, there is a lot of invention going on. And there are going to be a lot of places where some of the news gets covered. But the big issue that you raise is a legitimate one because, you know, good journalism, sophisticated journalism, costs money.
Mm-hmm.
It costs money to staff a bureau in Baghdad. It costs money to staff a bureau at the State House or in Washington or in New York. It costs money to have an investigative unit that can take 6 months to work on a big story in a local community. Traditionally, those costs, that kind of journalism, has largely been subsidized by the newspaper industry. And we know what's happened even before this sort of current economic meltdown. All over the country, all over the newspaper industry, there have been cuts all across the board. The paper I worked at for 10 years, the Boston Globe, got rid of its last foreign bureau a couple of years ago. Got rid of its New York reporter, its roving national correspondent. So there is this real question about who's going to be able to afford to pay for quality journalism. We'll get a lot of information. In many ways, there are more sources of information than we've ever had before, obviously, thanks to technology. The question is, who's going to be able to pay for the kind of information that breaks a story about the Walter Reed Army Hospital in Washington, D.C., or Randy Duke Cunningham in San Diego, or the warrantless wiretap story that the New York Times did. And that's a bigger issue.
Right. And it's been said, and I'll say it again, because for this conversation it's quite pertinent, it seems to me as though quality journalism is extremely vital to our democracy.
No doubt about it. There's no substitute for a responsible, aggressive, fair, objective press doing its fundamental job, which is as a watchdog on other powerful institutions in the country, and having that function and having that kind of information and having that kind of information be credible is extremely important to a functioning democracy. And one of the things that, you know, some people worry about in this day and age is in this fragmenting media environment, we have a lot of, you know, we have fewer and fewer shared truths. You know, in this day and age, people, whether it's on cable TV or the Internet or magazines, wherever they want to go, can find what we call the news of validation, which means they can seek out news that tends to support and validate their own personal biases or points of view. You know, and a classic example is cable television. If you were a John McCain supporter during this election, you were probably watching a lot of the Fox News Channel if you were a cable news fan. If you were a Barack Obama supporter, you were probably watching a lot of MSNBC.
Right.
You had a liberal cable, you know, news network and a conservative cable news network. And not only did that mean that, frankly, that the pundits on the networks were saying different things or the anchors were saying different things or offering different opinions, but you were even getting different stories covered and different angles on stories, literally kind of a different news agenda at times. And so, you know, one of the fears is if we don't have, you know, a sort of a healthy, credible body of solid journalism that most Americans will acknowledge is accurate and good and reflects the reality as best we can tell, we could, you know, we could devolve even further into people seeking out the kind of, you know, the kind of news that simply validates what they already believe. And as a nation, fewer and fewer share truths. I mean, in this day and age, it's already impossible to believe that we could ever have anything like a Walter Cronkite again. You know, a guy, a nationally respected anchor who came on television every night at 6:30 and told America what was going on in America. Most of America believed him. I mean, there's some mythology to this, but, you know, it's kind of an article of faith that when Walter Cronkite came out and in his own cautious, judicious way, after the Tet Offensive, said that the United States could not win in Vietnam, to this day the Pentagon blames Walter Cronkite for shaping, you know, public opinion there. In this day and age, it's very hard to believe that one journalist or one news organization in such a polarized political environment as we have now would be able to command that kind of a broad base of credibility. But The flip side is we need to have news that most of the American public will recognize as accurate, aggressive, truthful, that doesn't have an ideological tint to it or isn't preaching to the converted.
So what – and I agree with you, as do many of our listeners. And so I'm wondering what it is that Americans can do to make sure that quality journalism is kept alive.
Well, there's a lot, you know, a lot of it. Here's what I would say. You know, Americans obviously should – first of all, you need to be media literate. And that means, you know, everybody should eat from the smorgasbord of news that's available, news commentary. Go to the Huffington Post. Go to the Drudge Report. Go to CNN. Go to MSNBC. Go to Fox. You know, sample a lot of different stuff, but you know, be able to recognize fact from fiction, opinion from journalism, and be willing to sometimes accept reporting that may make you a little bit uncomfortable. Obviously, you know, it would be nice if people would, you know, economically support their local newspaper to the extent that they can. You know, that would help. I think the big issue, really, you know, for the news business is going to be, you know, whether or not we can get folks to pay on some level for online content at some point, some way, somehow. That's really, in many respects, we understand that the print product isn't going to continue to go on the way it has, you know, for the last 20 or 30 years. It's going to be more and more diminishing. That could be fine. You know, people getting their news via computer isn't a bad thing in any way, shape, or form. In many respects, it will enhance news gathering. But if it's going to work, if these organizations are going to be able to pay for journalists who can do a job, the public at some point is going to have to, may well be asked to pony up something to pay for this quality of news. You know, there have been experiments before that Times, New York Times Select, you know, one of the more obvious ones where they walled off some of their premium content and you know, their best and most interesting op-ed journalists and made people pay, I think, about $50 a year. That obviously didn't work well enough. They had to stop that. You know, it might not be that. It might be micropayments. But at some point, people may be asked to help, you know, carry a little bit of the load of subsidizing journalism just by being willing to pay for some level of news online. That's going to be important.
Yeah. What's happening to our newspapers? The focus of this hour with the news today that there will be a new business model at the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News planning to stop home delivery most days of the week. They will deliver to subscribers on the most profitable days of the week, and those happen to be Sunday or Thursday or Friday or both. And then other days they will print slimmer single copy editions. There will also be staff cuts at both of those papers. And of course, this just joins a long list now of newspapers that are very much in debt, that may be going out of business completely or really paring down the product that they give us. I'm worried about it. I'm sure many of you are as well. I guess one of the central points of this hour is how do we make sure that we get quality journalism, investigative journalism that's well done, that informs us in America? It's a big question. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, John Meacham will be joining us, editor of Newsweek and author of American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. Let's go to phone calls now for Mark, starting with Will from Bailey's Harbor. Hi, Will.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for taking my call. My first reaction to this is that, you know, it's always tragic when you hear about, you know, more jobs being lost, and it's obviously a serious issue in that sense, but couldn't it be argued that, you know, the it's time for, you know, kind of everything to be changing and restructuring. You know, you have the auto industry doing what it's doing, and the news, and, you know, sector. I kind of feel like it's, you know, overcrowded with a lot of, you know, it's lacking a lot of pertinent, you know, quality. Also, really watered down, and I feel like, you know, it's we can't wait for the consumer to drive the quality up. So I think this will be an interesting scenario to watch unfold. I just curious how you feel the same way.
What newspapers do you count on, Will, if any?
I'm actually, I go online to the free media, the NewYorkTimes.com, and I watch, kind of like what you guys just commented on earlier, I watch across the board, left to the right, and realize that, you know, most of what I see and hear and read is, you know, has to be taken with a grain of salt, yet to have a full, broad perspective, you have to you know, encompass everything. And I just think there's a lot of waste, you know, out there. And I personally, I feel that a lot of people can't make the distinction, and they swallow everything they hear, and therefore, you know, we have a country that is where it's at.
Mark.
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, no doubt about it. You know, every industry needs to change and respond to technological and, you know, and economic realities. And frankly, the newspaper industry was slow to do so. One of the reasons it was slow to do so was for many years in many communities, owning a newspaper was a license to print money. Profit margins were over 20%, which, you know, is really, I you know, for the businessmen out there would give their eye teeth to be able to pull that down in a year. And, you know, even though people were aware the environment was changing, the newspaper industry was sort of hierarchical, a little paternalistic, a little arrogant, and it was slow in many respects to recognize what was happening, a little bit like the auto industry. Having said that, newsrooms all over America, frankly, have been scrambling to accept this change and to get leaner, meaner, you know, reporters who once just wrote stories are now out there with video cameras and driving around and editing their own pieces and doing multimedia pieces. So a lot of that scrambling is going on in the newsroom. And frankly, there's some evidence that actually in many news organizations, newspaper organizations, the newsroom itself is now sort of more acceptable and amenable to significant changes in what they're doing than the business side, which has really had to relearn many of its old habits. And I can also, you know, I think it's also fair to say that, I mean, believe it or not, people have mentioned this, you know, should the government bail out the newspaper industry? I don't think that's going to happen.
Right.
There is going to be a shakeout. There already has been a shakeout. You know, some newspapers are going to die out. There's no question about it. Almost all of them have gotten leaner and meaner and smaller and lower staffed in recent years. Many of them will flip over into an online environment. In the salad days, there was a lot of there was a lot of sort of spending of money, like drunken sailors and rich expense accounts, and all of that's changing now at an accelerated pace. So I think what your caller is suggesting is in the process of happening. The question is, though, you know, is there going to be some system, some business model, some combination of business models that's going to subsidize, you know, the really good journalism? And you know, your caller made the point that, you know, yeah, that's part of the problem of the country right now. There's a mishmash of opinion. There's this hybrid of opinion and news out there, and most people swallow it hook, line, and sinker. Well, if that's what we end up devolving into, then we've got some problems.
Right. Thanks, Will, for the call. Jeff is next from La Crosse. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I won't identify it on the air, but I run an online niche market media outlet, and really, so this, you know, whole trend is in our best interest. But nonetheless, I see some very, very disturbing trends, because what a lot of people do not understand about the online environment is access to that environment is far from uniformly distributed across this country. I mean, you have entire regions that don't have good internet access. And one of the trends that you're seeing in internet content in general is a much denser and denser content. So unless you have, a connection speed that keeps up with that density, your ability to get to the information is decreasing with that site. You know, the reasons for the decline, I think, are multiform, and I think you've identified them quite well. And I think it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what comes out. But what I predict, and I'll listen to the response off the air, is that what we're going to see is much, much more in the way of what might be called sort of, hobby journalism. And this, again, is in our interest, but I don't like it. That is outsourced stories and outsourced reporting to people that are, you know, Lord knows where, whether they're in your hometown or not, they may or may not be. I don't know that that's good for information. And then secondly, I see an emerging trend of uneven distribution to access of information, which in a democracy, you know, representative republic, that's not good. So it'll be interesting to see how this thing writes itself, if it does. But I think fundamentally, the rules have changed. I'll
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks. Interesting
points. Mm-hmm. You know, and the information divide point is a really good. I mean, you know, at one point when you know newspapers were the primary way of getting information, or you know, broadcast television, which is free once you buy the TV. It's not like cable. You know, everybody sort of had pretty simple access to information. A quarter in the mailbox in the news box got you. You know, everybody could get today's news and be on even footing. You know, there was a lot of talk about, quote, information have and have-nots once the Internet really took flight. Truth is, you know, many people are wired, but his point about, you know, the capabilities of that wiring, the access to denser information is a good one. So also, frankly, is the fact that, you know, the Internet has many, many things on it. And by definition, and there are whole cultural issues and you know, social issues and generational issues, people can choose, regardless of what kind of hookup they have, they can choose to spend their time, you know, on NewYorkTimes.com, or they can choose to spend their time all day on TMZ.com. Not that there's anything wrong with TMZ.com if you like gossip, but, you know, or on a, you know, or on a football site, or on a betting site, or, you know, anything. So that's a, you know, a very legitimate issue. On the issue of outsourcing journalism and homegrown journalism, one of the trends that sort of developed in recent years in this environment was something we called citizen media. And actually there was a study of it a couple of years ago at the University of Maryland. And what this really was in many communities, the sort of with the big papers in more trouble, that, you know, a lot really passionate local activists were creating their own websites and starting to try and fill the void of, you know, of community news. You know, they didn't have journalism training necessarily. Some were, some weren't. These were, many of them were mom and pop operations. They cost almost nothing to start. Many people were, you know, people worked for free. Many people said they weren't even trying to make money on it. It was really sort of a passionate labor of love kind of environment. And at the time that this study came out, the University of Maryland was able to identify 700 or 800 of them across the country, and there was a lot of enthusiasm behind it. But the truth is, as time has gone on, there's been some cooling of the idea that this is really going to be the savior. I mean, of the next step in American journalism, that we're going to just have, you know, people in their communities covering the news and sort of serving as reporters. You know, in many respects, that's not their day job. They don't necessarily have, they don't have journalistic training. They may not have journalistic standards or practices. So there's been some dampening of enthusiasm that somehow this sort of new brigades of volunteers are going to you know, fill out the ranks and make things work. And that's all part of, you know, this sort of where the industry is right now, which is in this very experimental, you know, we'll try anything environment. There may not be one model. There may be many different models. And we really have to just look for a series of experiments or ideas that, you know, when aggregated, is going to work. And I'll give you an example. You know, I talked about ProPublica, which is, you know, a big operation, again, funded by private donors from California, whose ideology is pretty well known. If, you know, and they're talking about partnering with other media outlets, if 10 or 15 years ago a journalistic organization come around and said, hey, look, we're going to do investigative journalism, and we're funded by a very wealthy guy whose politics are well known, and would you like to be involved with us? What do you think? There would have been a lot of wariness.
Sure.
You know, this sort of idea of, well, wait, is there an agenda here? You know, is there a conflict of interest here? So this guy's politics, and now he's got a bunch of investigative reporters. I don't, you know, there would have been sort of, I'm not sure this is, you know, we think we can do it better as a private company. In this day and age, everybody has embraced, not only did they get essentially about 1,300 applications for 25 jobs there, but, you know, if you look at sort of the people who have signed on or supported it or lauded it, I mean, it's many of the bigwigs in journalism. The idea now that there might be some agenda or something has been superseded completely by the industry's understanding that we've just got to try new things. So now there are no, you know, everybody is opening their arms to this kind of experimentation, and that's really where we are in the business.
Let's go next to Mary from Madison. Hi, Mary.
This is just a fascinating topic. I used to freelance full-time for one of the major metropolitan newspapers and was actually offered a job but did not want to live in a large city. And I have watched with great dismay what I can only call the dumbing down of the newspapers. Honestly, I think that nothing would have prevented their demise. And I can only remember when it was the most exciting place to be. It seemed as if everybody I knew wanted to be a journalist.
Yes.
I think there was a problem from the get-go as far as investigative reporting being done via a vehicle that had to be supported by its advertisers, who definitely, in many cases, did not want to be investigated. But for me, the largest crunch, the biggest disappointment came with the dumbing down, which apparently was done in an effort to appeal to more people. And there was a point at which everything I wrote was being gone over by editors, and they said literally to me, we don't want to see words with more than three or four letters. People don't understand them. Now, I mean no disrespect to your guest when I say I lost count after several hundred of the number of times he said, you know, I mean, like. And I wonder again and again when I listen to Dana Purino why a generation with this much education has adopted the speech of toddlers, this very know-nothing, tentative, I need permission to talk stance. I'm just mystified. In program after program with reporters on, every other phrase seems to be, I mean, you know, like, as if they're 10-year-olds. And I was hoping your guest could tell me, apart from adopting the speech of the moment, I literally at this point listen to nothing but BBC News because they speak like grown-ups. I can take them seriously. And again, I mean no offense to your guest. He sounds like everybody else. But I would love to know if he was aware of this very conscious decision we were told was made to appeal to people with almost no education. I think at that point, with the best of intentions, they lost the majority of their readership to other vehicles. And I think what's opening up now is very exciting, and I'm so looking forward to being part of it. Another problem has been I have a relative that reached the top of the business, but now in his late 40s, the pay is still not commensurate with his experience. Again, this is just part of the whole industry, and it makes me very sad, but I think it's going to push us in new directions. But I would love to hear what your guest has to say about everybody adopting the speech of young children.
Mark.
Well, like you know, I'm not sure. I guess on the verbal tics, I would have to blame it on the American public education system or me watching too much television as a kid. I would like to say that I think that when it came to actually writing for newspapers, that either I didn't insert those words into my stories or the editors took them out so that I didn't sound like a 10-year-old toddler. But the idea that there's been a dumbing down in the industry, I think there are other news outlets other than the BBC that probably speak the King's English at this point and that can get a complex thought through it in pretty articulate English. But the idea that that newspapers began to dumb down or the news industry began to dumb down, you know, is something that's been out there for quite some time. I mean, people forget that, you know, whenever USA Today, and by the way, I should say that I think Barack Obama uses the term, you know, fairly often, too. So I feel like I'm in pretty good company. But when USA Today began and it was sort of derided as McPaper, because it had short stories and lots of color and graphics and charts and stories didn't jump onto page two. And people thought at that point that was going to be the end of journalism as we knew it. One of the problems that has happened in the business as the economy has tightened and as the economics of journalism has gotten rougher is that, many journalists have sort of ceded, you know, have become much more consumer-oriented in what they think, you know, the public will tolerate. At one point, there was a sense, for example, that, you know, who's supposed to decide what gets published? You know, is it supposed to be journalists who tell the American public this is the important story today, or is it supposed to be the American public who might want to read a fun story on page one or a story about dogs or a short story? In other words, this debate began over who's, you know, is it, do we need to feed them their vegetables or should we give them dessert first? And as the economy got worse and worse, and as the media business got in more and more trouble, more and more of that decision-making became, let's give the consumers what they say they want. And they say they want shorter stories, and they want prettier pictures. And they really don't want to read about these, you know, nuanced coverage of big municipal issues. And let's not jump our stories onto page three, and let's shorten our stories, and let's punch up the graphics. That's been happening a lot. And it's been going on over time, and it's been a response, frankly, to the sense that the public has less time for news and is less interested in spending time on news, so let's give them something prettier. In many cities, one of the most interesting experiments that we've had in journalism have been the sort of the arrival of these small commuter daily tabloids. In Chicago, you have the Red Eye. In Boston and Philadelphia, you have a paper called the Metro. In D.C., where I live, you have a paper called the Express, which is actually published by the Washington Post Company. These are they're almost like the cliff notes of a regular newspaper. You pick them up at the train station. They're meant to be digested in 15 or 20 minutes. Every short story is short. These are, in many cases, mainstream news organizations themselves cranking out their own sort of mini products on the assumption that the public doesn't have the time or the interest in delving into anything more substantive. Now, part of that's supposed to be resolved with all of the opportunities that are available through online journalism. Here is a medium that doesn't have a news hole. It's an infinite news hole. You don't have to worry about how many words are in a story. Any given story can have audio, it can have video, it can have links to 25 other stories. So in essence, you have this endlessly deep news hole in the online world in which people can simply read the story or look at the picture, or they can spend an entire day linking to all of the relevant aspects to that story. So on some level, if the print products have been dumbed down and packaged more prettily and stories have gotten shorter, part of the thinking was, hey, you can get anything you want, from superficial to incredibly deep in the online world.
Mark Jerkowitz is with us. He's Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism and has spent nearly 20 years covering the news media. He's been a commentator on CNN and NPR, was a radio talk show host in Boston, and spent 10 years at the Boston Globe, initially as the paper's ombudsman and then its full-time media beat writer. We're going to continue our conversation and add to it in just a moment. I don't know if you saw this story, bittersweet story in the New York Times yesterday, an imperiled newspaper's place in a small city's fabric. It comes from Bristol, Connecticut, and goes like this. In an office so quiet as to be disruptive, a man sits amid his chosen career, the collected reports of the Connecticut Freedom of Information Commission, Volume 1, a letter seeking publicity for an event sponsored by the Litchfield County chapter of Hadassah, stacks of newspapers, days, weeks, months old. This is William Sarno, 63 years old, editor of an ancient and endangered newspaper called the Bristol Press. We'll be speaking with him about the future of his newspaper and the place it served in the town of Bristol in a moment, and continue our conversation with Mark and with you. Our phone lines are pretty crowded right now, but keep the number in mind, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, John Meacham will be joining us, the editor of Newsweek, and has written just a real great read, and it's wonderfully written, and it's this guy was quite a president. We don't know all that much about him because we're spending a lot of time on Lincoln and FDR, et cetera, but the person who Lincoln studied was Andrew Jackson, so we're going to talk about Andrew Jackson and John's new book, American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. Joining us now for a few minutes, I don't know if you saw this story. It was in the New York Times yesterday, an imperiled newspaper's place in a small city's fabric. And our guest is the editor of this newspaper. His name is William Sarno. He is editor of the Bristol Press in Bristol, Connecticut. And we thank you so much for being with us to talk about the future of your newspaper. Good morning to you, William. Hello, William. Are you there? Hello? We don't have William, so we'll try and reach him. I don't know what the problem is here. Let me check and make sure we're all set. Yeah, we should be. William, can you hear me? Well, we'll try and get him on here. We're just not making connection, although we did earlier, so we know he's there. We'll just go to another phone call, and let us go to Jim from Harvard next. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good. All right, my comment here is that Harvard, Illinois, that is.
I know Harvard. My grandfather and grandmother lived there, and I used to go there every Sunday morning.
Home of milk days. Everybody come on out.
You're right.
All right. Enough of the news, right? Ultimately, what I'm thinking here is if the majority of the public couldn't pay for the news given to them, would that result in a public of non-informed, non-caring citizens, or a public of historical and hysterical citizens filled with quick, nonsensical decisions as decision makers?
Are you there, Mark?
I'm sorry. Sure.
Okay.
So I'm not sure I got the question, though. You're saying...
Yeah, I'll repeat it real quick.
Sure, go ahead.
If the majority of the public couldn't pay for the news given to them,
right,
would that result in a public of non-informed, non-caring citizens, or a public of hysterical citizens filled with quick, nonsensical decision...
Well, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. You know, you might get a combination of both. Now,
yeah, but as 51% would be what?
Oh, I don't. Boy, you're asking. You'd have to ask a sociologist. But the truth,
sure.
I mean, the truth is that no one's not going to be. I mean, if you have a computer or a television set, no one's not going to be able to afford some kind of news. I mean, right now, I don't know about your online habits, but I don't pay for anything that I go to online. And I can avail myself of websites all over the country all day long.
But you pay for the connection.
Well, but most people are hooked up in some way. If you don't have a computer, I guess what I'm saying is this. News is still cheap. The problem really isn't necessarily on the consumer side. I mean, there are newspaper boxes still all over the country. They haven't vanished yet. And most of them, you know, it's 25 cents or 50 cents or maybe 75 cents a day. If you want to pick up a newspaper.
Wait, Mark, real quick.
The
news means
yeah,
better news. More expensive news means better news. What's the equation there?
Well, more expensive. Yeah, it costs money, obviously, to do the kind of quality, real quality journal. That doesn't mean day in and day out you've got to have an investigative story on page one. There's plenty to be said for beat reporters who are watching City Hall, watching the community, watching the school system. But obviously, you know, ambitious reporting costs money. Investigative reporting costs money. Having bureaus costs money. The public doesn't have to directly subsidize all those costs. That's not necessarily the business model. But there, and obviously in the old days, advertisers subsidized those costs, and they subsidized them because the newspaper was such a monopolistic enterprise in many communities that they knew they were going to reach a lot of eyeballs. It worked for everybody.
Right, Citizen Kane.
So the question is, we're not asking the public, you know, throw money into a pot so that people can afford this. There just has to be a more effective business model that might involve people like yourself or myself saying, okay, I will pay a little bit of money for online journalism, or I will go to websites where I have to subscribe at some point. It's not going to mean that people are going to have to dig deep, you know, day in and day out to support this.
Thank you very much for your call, Jim.
Thank you.
And Mark, thank you so much. We're going to go to Bill now for a few minutes to talk about small town newspapers. Appreciate your being with us this for a whole hour. Thanks, Mark.
Sure.
And joining us now is Bill Sarno. He is editor of the Bristol Press in Bristol, Connecticut. This newspaper has been covering Bristol since 1871. Bill, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Morning, Bill. It was a bittersweet article in the New York Times yesterday, wasn't it?
Yes, it sort of captures the mood very well of what's going on in the newsroom and the community. But I've been listening to the discussion and agree a lot with Mark said. It's changing times, and we have to change. And what I feel is unfortunate is these are the types of discussions that probably should have taken place 5, 6, 10 years ago, but a lot of newspapers, as Mark and others could tell you, were gobbled up by corporations, and the people in charge of these corporations, like people in charge of the Tribune and various other ones, are not as well-versed in newspapers as they should be in the media, and they looked at them, they saw that 20% profit margin, and they were gobbling up income and cash flow, and they really, they thought they were visionary, and visionary meant, well, let's look at more photos, more color, more box scores,
right,
this redesign and stuff. And now we're in a crisis, and I'm down at the, you know, low end. Bristol's not definitely a small town. It's a 60,000 person community. It's the home of ESPN, so it sort of has a national cachet. But who knows what will happen. We're hopeful that somebody will pick us up. And my concern, too, is not so much, well, equally what their journalism viewpoint is, what their business plan is.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been in the newspaper business, Bill?
Since 1969.
Oh, my.
Yeah, ink and hot type and, you know, a lot of changes, which is fine. Now, change is part of life, but, you know, again, newspapers were, what, they sold for a quarter. You know, now they sell for 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
Gasoline was a quarter back then. And we know how much that's gone up in price. So I guess, you know, newspapers were a utility of sorts, and they didn't overprice themselves, and maybe they just didn't keep up with how much it really costs to put out the product they were making. I don't think the oil companies would underprice their gasoline or anything like that. They know how much it costs to buy the oil and stuff, but I don't think newspapers to some extent realize that, you know, local news gathering is an expensive endeavor.
We're yes.
foot soldiers.
Yeah, sure it is. I can't imagine a paper that's been around your community since 1871 going under. You must serve. You have this long history, and you must serve a vital place in the community, don't you?
Sure. You know, we survived a couple World Wars.
Right.
The Depression, a couple other wars going on in the last 20 years, and 1955, there was a great flood, and the bottom of this building was flooded, and we printed in some other town temporarily, but, you know, the paper keeps going. But, you know, times have changed. We have a website which gets, you know, several thousand visitors a day. Unfortunately, people who say, well, we will miss the paper, we'll get our news from the Internet, but it's they don't understand the day, if the day comes when the print edition stops, the plug will be pulled on the website also.
Mm-hmm.
So where is this news information going to come from? I mean, we deal with a whole level of news that you're really not going to get on ESPN's in town, but they're not going to cover the local football game.
Right.
How are people going to know who died?
Right.
There
oh,
is a
yeah.
weekly, you know, by the time you get that, the person's funeral is long gone and everything like that.
You know, oh, I didn't even think of that. Yeah.
You know, just little vital services we provide. And we cover government and stuff like that, sure. That's important. But it's a whole gamut of information that we provide. It's changed through the years. I don't think people turn to the Bristol Press to find out what's happening in Baghdad or Washington, D.C. so much. But they are concerned what's happening in Bristol, the surrounding areas, and to some extent, the state of Connecticut.
Well, do you have hopes that somebody will be able to purchase the paper and you can survive, or are those
well, there,
do you not?
There are talk that there is at least one party interested in not only buying the Bristol, there's also another paper, the New Britain Herald, probably equally as old, that also has been told that there is not a buyer by January 12th to look to probably close the doors, and there's another dozen or so weeklies involved in this also. It's a big area, but, you know, there's economic factors which can't be denied. This is not the best of times, and most communities that, well, we were going back to the so-called salad days that Mark mentioned, you know, there was locally owned department stores and everything like that. Now you have the big box stores, and you don't get the same type of advertising. The mom pops can't survive. I'm interested in the Detroit thing, only to the extent one of the things that's been talked about here is we're now 7 days a week. Do we really have to print 7 days a week? Can we print maybe 4 days a week and use the Internet to supplement
sure.
that on the other 3 days or something? You know,
sure.
I mean, all these ideas have to be tossed around.
That sounds like a good idea to me, Bill. I'd push for that so you can keep printing. Bill, thank you very much for being with us, and best of luck to you. I hope the paper survives.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bill Sarno, he's editor of the Bristol Press in Bristol, Connecticut. And there's another whole story there, the survival of newspapers that aren't as large that he says, and of course he's right, serve a vital role in a community. This one around since 1871. And as he said, how will you know who died? That's true. I look at the obituaries. Now I'm old enough to look at that and to read about people's lives. His story is featured in the New York Times. If you want to read more about the Bristol paper, yesterday's paper, an imperiled newspaper's place in a small city's fabric. Well, I'm left wondering what the future of newspapers happens to be. I don't know. I need them. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour. And thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thank you for your calls, everybody. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of you and to all of our emails, but we'll talk about this issue again. It would be good to have Bill on for a longer period of time sometime. News ahead, radio news. Always count on radio news. And we'll return with another hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.